Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hot Topics from the Soul with your host, Dr. Valerie N. Parker, businesswoman, author, speaker, and life coach. Dr. Parker is the president of Arise by VMP, which is a speakers bureau and public relations company. She is also the visionary and founder of the Soul of a Woman Foundation that brings awareness to domestic violence and children living in single-parent homes. Hot Topics from the Soul is a virtual lifeline to the community, discussing social and political issues, relationships, finances, motivation, and inspiration. For information regarding products, services, and resources, visit www.fromthesoulofawoman.com. That's www.fromthesoulofawoman.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I now present to you your host, Dr. Valerie Parker.
Good evening and welcome to Hot Topics from the Soul. I'm delighted to be with you here on this Tuesday. Well, it's October and it's Domestic Violence Month along with Cancer Awareness Month. And tonight we have a special guest and I have my co-host, Shirley Carter, that will be tuning in with us. Shirley, are you there?
I am here. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. As Val stated, this is October for National Domestic Violence and also for Breast Cancer Awareness. So you're in for a treat tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you know, those that are new to the show, my foundation, the Soul of a Woman, serves domestic violence and children living in single-parent homes. And if you want to know more information about that, you can go to my website, www.fromthesoulofawoman.com. And Shirley, you have a cancer awareness nonprofit. Could you talk about that, please?
Yes. I have Against All Odds, which is a breast cancer organization that helps breast cancer patients. We don't do the research. We do support, though, the American Cancer Society, but we support the patient with their, some of their basic needs as far as emotionally, economically, some of the financial things that they may need. It's just the general daily things. So the organization has been around for 16 years. Our website is againstalloddsinc.com, and visit us on Facebook. And so we're bringing about awareness to women that are going through, to their family, and also supporting the children, because the children are also someone that needs to know how do they handle this when their parent or, you know, a loved one is going through. What are some of the things they can do to help them go through? So, Val, and I'm excited about tonight, our guests and everything, and your organization. I have to tell everyone that's listening, if you have not been to her Facebook page or to her website, please do, because you can become, as Val has said before, you can become a soul partner, because we all need someone somewhere in our lives, and then to have partners that could be there to help us in that time of need is priceless. So, you know, we both take donations. I want to say that to our listeners. And we're always looking for volunteers to help out because, you know, not so much to give a hand out, but a hand up. So I just want to share that with you.
Yes, thank you so much for that, Shirley. You know, you can go to my website and donate to the foundation, the Soul of a Woman Foundation. And, you know, people say, well, I don't have that much to give. But, you know, if you can give $10, all the people I have following me would donate $10 to the Soul of a Woman Foundation, we would be set for the rest of the year to do all the different things that we need to do. You know, when you start small and then you can build big. So when you're trying to give $100 and $200, a lot of times, you know, it just isn't in the budget. But everybody can give $10. So I invite you to go to the website and see all the different things that I'm doing. And, you know, tonight being it's Domestic Violence Month, we're always talking about the victim of victims of domestic violence and the different things that they go through. As a, I'm a survivor, I was married 19 years to a pastor and was a victim of domestic violence, and my children were affected by that. I have four children, and it was hard going through that situation and staying in it as long as I did. People say to me all the time, well, Val, how could you stay in a situation that long? I wouldn't have done that. I couldn't take that. But, you know, I often tell people you can't see that picture when you're in the frame. As a victim of domestic violence, and especially when you have children, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And you don't understand what you don't know. And it's easier said than done to get out. I was displaced. All my family was in New York and South Carolina, so me here in South Florida, I was alone. I was stripped of everything that was familiar to me and all the resources I had, so I thought I had no other option. And when you're in a situation like that, you are stuck. You can't move, and especially when the individual controls the finances. But I have motivational speaker Jason Oliver visiting with us tonight, and he's going to share from his perspective the different things that he went through, because, you know, men cry in the dark. A lot of times they lash out because they don't understand what's going on within themselves. Well, I'm not going to get ahead. I'm going to let Jason talk about that. Jason, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I appreciate you willing to come on and talk from your perspective regarding domestic violence.
No problem at all. It's an honor. Thank you for inviting me this evening.
Now, Jason, you're a motivational speaker right now.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I am.
Okay, so how did you choose this path of speaking?
Well, as it is, I've always loved to run my mouth, even as a child. But more importantly, when I was in high school, I was living with a foster family. My foster father made it a point for me to enter into debate and forensics my freshman year. And forensics, which is like dramatic interpretation, humorous interpretation, acting, so on and so forth, dramatic interpretation is where I really flourished and I became a state champion. I did a, I don't know if you're familiar with August Wilson, he has a play called Fences. And mm-hmm. I did an excerpt from Fences, and I won the state championship in Missouri, and I qualified for the national championships, but me being who I was then, I got in trouble and couldn't go. So every opportunity I had, I would speak after that. And, you know, years later when I got into the ministry, you know, I gave sermons here and there, and then I kind of just dropped off. And for the last 4 years, you know, it's been burning inside of my chest to get out there and speak and to share my story. And this is where I am now. So I believe it's something that mm-hmm. I'm destined to do with my life.
Okay, so what is your story?
Okay, that's a loaded question. There's so many segments of it, you know. I guess it's best to start at the beginning. This is being told to me from my mother. My father was a pimp in Florida, St. Petersburg, Tampa Bay area. And this didn't come from her. I asked her a question one time if she was, you know, his white girl. My father's black, my mother's white. And mm-hmm. I shouldn't have asked her that question. She went crazy on me. This was after we reconnected. But the story came to me from my uncle that my mother was indeed my father's white girl. You know, back in the 70s, that was the thing for a pimp to have, a black pimp to have, is that one white girl that made him his money. Mm-hmm. Well, eventually, my mother got pregnant. And there are some stories I remember as a youth how my father and mother would talk about if I didn't have a specific birthmark, then I wasn't his. And I never really thought about that until I learned later on, you know, that I may not have been his, but we do share the same birthmark. My grandmother and my sister have it. Well, my father had that pimp mentality, okay, that if a woman, he wouldn't take anything from a woman. So if she tried to loud talk, out talk, back talk him, in his words, become a snapdragon, then he would do what he had to do to get her under control. And my mother, being who she was and living that life, she was a professional thief. You know, she got into drugs real heavy, so on and so forth. You know, and this was even before I came around. But the genesis of everything for me were my life really, the life that played out for me really began was my father would come home drunk sometimes 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And he would come in, yell my name, and he would just rip me out of my sleep. He would force me to come in and sit on the couch. And the whole time, he's holding my mother by her hair. And he would force me to sit there and look at him. And I remember him uttering these words, "This is how you control a woman." Now, I'm 6-7 years old. This happened more than once, but the occasion that really stands out in my mind and my memory is when he sat me down, looked at me again, and repeated those words he always did, "This is how you control a woman." And he broke my mother's jaw. And that's where the anger, the first time that I can truly remember being filled with anger and being filled with rage. I wanted to do something to my father. I wanted to kill my father. I remember telling myself that I would never, ever grow up to be like him or to be like my mother as well. So needless to say, with this type of home life, the state got involved, SRS, Social Services of Kansas. And actually, they got involved in 1979 when my father came home drunk and beat my mother and I on Christmas Eve, and she had called the police. Well, over a period of 3 years until I was 9 years old, I was in and out of foster care. I would go to a children's home, and this would happen. I would be home for 2 months. Something would take off. My mother would call the police, and they would come and get me, and then I would be in a group home for 3 months, and I'd go back home for 2 months, and I'd go back to a foster home because something else took place. My father continued with the abuse. I remember one particular situation where I was in the kitchen doing the dishes, and you remember those old steak knives that had the wooden handle, those serrated knives that had the wooden handle. Well, we had a green linoleum countertop. And I remember washing the dishes, and I lost the knife, and the knife began to dance across the countertop, and I went over to reach it, and as I did, I knocked a plate out of the drying rack, and it fell on the floor and shattered. And my father came in there, make a long story short, picked me up by my throat and slammed my head repeatedly against the freezer. Father's a big man. I'm the smallest male in my family, and I'm almost 6 foot. And my mother came in there and was pulling him off of me, trying to pull him off of me, and the whole time, I didn't know that I had the knife in my hand, and it was positioned at his gut. Out of fear, I didn't do anything with it. He looked down, saw it, dropped me, and went back to doing whatever he was doing. You know, he was an alcoholic. My mother,
wow,
a drug addict. Yeah. My mother, a drug addict. My mother had a, how can I say this? My mother had... I always looked at my father as like a force of nature, like a thunderstorm or something, something that just came and went. But my mother, in my opinion, she was the worst of the two. Because there would be moments when she would be so lovey-dovey with me and, you know, just like a mother is to a child, and then the next moment she would flip on me. I remember on multiple occasions she would tie me up with telephone cords, bind my feet, bind my arms, my wrist, and she would sit on my chest and punch me dead square in my face and just keep wailing away at me. You know, she would choke me until I would pass out. She used to have those real long, strong nails, and I have scars on my arms to this day from when she dug in them. But one situation really stressed. She had a Gran Torino. If you remember Starsky and Hutch, that type of car, she had one of those. And you remember those old door handles where you had to put your four fingers through and use your thumb to open the door with, right? Well, one time we were on a dirt road, and I had did something. And she took my hand and forced it into the handle of the door. And she took off down the road while I'm attached to the car door. And I was running for my life, and then there were some times when I was dragged, and she would slow down so I could get back up, and then she'd take off again. that was probably the scariest time that I had as a child. With all that being said, you know, in the state getting involved, my behavior ended up becoming worse and worse and worse, to where when I was in elementary school, I could only go a half day, and I'm in third grade because my behavior was so
bad.
Right. And the rage would just come up and bubble up inside of me. And I remember one time there was a teacher. Her name was Mrs. White. I had did something, and she was trying to restrain me. I don't know if I'll get into it with another student or what, but I remember biting a hole through the meat between her thumb and her forefinger. There was a, you know, the rage in me began to bubble up more and more and more. There was a girl at my, this is the first time that I would always get into fights with other guys, you know, but this was the first time that the, you could see the beginnings of my abusive nature towards women. There was a young girl, her name was Adrian. And we went to school together. I was 9 years old. This was a couple months before I was taken away permanently from my parents. I was 9 years old, and she was just as sweet as she could be, always grinning, always smiling. And we would play around. We rode the bus together. We lived in the same projects together. Then one day, just out of the blue, we were walking home, and I stopped and I looked at her. And I hauled off, and I punched her in her face.
Wow.
And I remember her screams, and I remember her asking why. I immediately bolted for home, and I went and hid in my closet. At 9 years old, I still remember that I wasn't concerned about how she felt or what I actually did to her. I was more concerned with if I would get in trouble, if I would be found out. Unfortunately, she never told her mother. She never told her father. So this behavior continued.
Now, let me ask you, did this behavior continue against her specifically, or was did you find it convenient to lash out at all young girls? Were you more or less the bully towards the girls?
It was just towards her at this time. She was the only
one. So you repeatedly accosted her?
Yes, ma'am. And each time, it graduated a level.
Did you like
I remember
her at
she
all?
Not in the, you know, traditional boy-girl sense, you know, having a crush on her or anything. But as I remember, she liked me to a certain degree. And I wonder if that's one of the reasons why she never told. You know, she was cool as a friend, you know, but I never was attracted to her, you know, in that sense.
Okay.
But like I said, the level of abuse began to, it graduated from level to level. And I'm 9 years old. To where, you know, we're talking about leaving bruises, and she would go home with a bloody mouth. And she never told. And you know, Valerie, and Cheryl, one of the things that I carry around with me today is that I don't know where she's at today. I don't know what she's going through, and I wonder if I have anything to do with whether or not she's unhappy to this day. You know, is she in an abusive relationship because of what I did to her at 9 years old? You know, why did she never tell? Did what I do to her cause her to be silent the rest of her life? Is she living that kind of life? Now, this is something that I deal with and I think about, you know, on a regular basis regarding her. And like I said, that was my first step towards that that bullying towards a woman. However, there was another person, you know, before I left to go to the detention centers and lockup, that I attacked. And I didn't remember this. I remembered I only did it one time, but when I got back in contact with my mother, later on in as an adult, she brought this thing up to me and found out that I did it multiple times. But the one time that I remember, my mother came in to my bedroom. I was 9 years old. This is right around the same time, you know. And I was playing a song by a group called Nucleus, and it was too loud. And she told me to turn it down, and I wouldn't turn it down. So she went over, turned it down. I went over and turned it back up. I'm 9 years old now. My father is on the other side of town. My mother, you know, have guys coming in and out of the house, you know. And so I didn't think nothing about it until she came over and pushed me up against the wall. And I noticed something. I'll never forget this. My mother was shorter than I was. And
At nine.
My mother was 5'3". Okay. At nine, my mother was shorter than I was. And when that thought finally hit me, all of my frustrations, my anger, my rage was released upon her that day.
Wow.
I attacked and beat my own mother.
Wow.
And this is something that you know, I still try to fight through, you know?
Right.
So, but I attacked my mother across the entire room. From my mind, I thought that I had just pushed her and pushed her and pushed her. But after I spoke with her, she said that I repeatedly, with my fist ball, attacked her. Until the guy that she was with came in and pulled me off of her.
Wow.
In my mind, I only remember doing that one time, but she said I did it on multiple times, and I think that is something that she would remember. I may have blocked that, the rest of those things out.
Mm-hmm.
The way
let
I
me
felt
ask
afterwards.
You,
go ahead.
Jason. You know, let me ask you about that, because as I said, that I lived with an abuser for 19 years, well, 17 of the 19 years. And if you ask him today or bring up or ask, was he an abuser, he would look at you and honestly say, no, he wasn't. He doesn't remember any of the things he did to me or the children. I don't know if he... You know, so I've often wondered, does he really not remember, or is he just, because he's too embarrassed, saying he doesn't?
Mm-hmm. In this situation, like I said, I can only speak for me, but talking, you know, when I was in the anger management classes later on down the road, we all remembered everything that we did. I remembered everything that I did as an adult towards my first wife. Like I said, it was because I was a youth at that time, so some things may have been blocked out, but you remember what you did. You can be, you have to understand that, you know, being the victim, you know, in this in an abusive relationship, they experience denial, embarrassment, shame, they begin to blame themselves. The abuser... Now, listen at this. This is the honest-to-goodness truth. The abuser, more often than not, believe that they were justified in their actions.
Well,
when
yeah.
I say that again?
I said, yeah, because at the time, you know, you feel that, you know, you have the power and you have the authority to operate and to work, and that's why it's so easy for the abuser to do what he does, because he feels that he's right.
And not only that, but as a man, and it's unfortunate that, especially, you know, things are done differently now, more so than they were back in the 70s and 80s and further back, but the man is taught that a woman, my father taught me that a woman is not to challenge me. She's not to challenge my authority, my judgment, or anything. And the moment that she does, it is my responsibility to, and we've heard this so much,
put
her
in check.
In check, back in her place, in a woman's place.
Mm-hmm,
So with that type of thinking and that type of conditioning, because one of the things that I learned later on down the road that my father and the behavior and the lifestyle that was in my house at an early age conditioned me to see the world in a specific way and to respond to it in a specific way, even though it was totally dead wrong. That I felt when my, now listen to this, this is very important, when after I attacked my mother, this one time that I remember, that I recall, I did not feel bad at that time. I do not feel like I do now as an adult. At that time, I felt justified. I felt that everything that I had been, everything that had been built up in me was finally directed at the right place, that my mother deserved what she got. Now, this is a nine-year-old child saying this, thinking this, that his mother now, after that whole situation went down, I ran out, I escaped out the window, jumped up on the roof, and slept up on the roof for the night. And I did not feel bad at all because I felt I was in the right. And that was the beginning of that warped mentality, you know, that abuser, that an abuser has. When I attacked Adrian, that young girl, I never felt bad when I did it. At 9 years old, I never felt bad for attacking her viciously like I did. It just didn't happen. I was just hoping that I didn't get in trouble.
Wow.
So, it starts young, and you know, it gets in you, and it becomes a part of who and what you are, and every step that you take leads you further and further down that road to oblivion, and whoever is attached to you at the hip goes with you, unless they know how to cut it off. This thing, you know, it's a shame that we have to have a Domestic Violence Awareness Month. You know, it's important that we have it, but it's a shame that there's 7 billion of us on the planet, and we don't know how to love and respect one another, you know? But as I, around this time at 9, I don't remember, I know that this was during the school year in 1984, I finally did something. I don't, you know, it was an accumulation of things that the ward of the state decided to put me in a level 5 detention center. Well, the thing is that I was so violent as a youth that there was no place in the state of Kansas that they could put me in for my age bracket. They would have to put me in an older, you know, an older youth facility, but I was too young by law to go there. So they had to send me to the state of Missouri. It was November 18th, 1984. I went to Gillis Home for Boys. It's a level, like I said, it's a level 5 institution with magnetically sealed doors. It was a little prison, you know, for lack of a better word. you know, you had staff. You know, I was on medication there. They first put me on Ritalin. That didn't do anything. Then they put me on a drug called Miloril, which was like a behavioral suppressant, you know, for lack of a better word. Then they that didn't work. Then they put me on Thorazine. I was doing 1,000 milligrams of Thorazine every day to try to keep my behavior at a certain level, but it didn't work. During the time that I stayed there, I was the most violent child at Gillis Home for Boys from 1984 to 1987. I repeatedly attacked staff. I repeatedly attacked other children. I got to a point that I was so bad that they had to create, they all got together, and they had to create, all the staff members and the therapists and counselors got together and created a program called One-on-One. Now, what this program was is that I could only associate with one staff member, and he was a male. When he was there during the day, I had to be in his shadow. I couldn't be no more than 5 to 6 feet away from him, as long as his shadow was. I couldn't interact with other kids or other staff. Whenever he went to have lunch, I would go to a thing they called isolation. You know, in prison they call it the hole. It's the same thing here. It was a little, I guess, 6x6 room. The dimension may have been a little bit bigger. But I remember it had one drain and a punching bag. And I would have to, you know, take off all my clothes, and I could only be in my briefs when I went in there.
Mm-hmm.
I would take my meals in there. I would do my schoolwork in there. Whenever I had to go to the restroom, I had to bang on the door. They would come in, big old magnetically sealed door, steel door with a little square window. They would let me out. At night, that's where I slept. I had a blanket, and I had that pillow, the punch bag as a pillow. And I was on this program for 3 weeks, and I stayed in the hole that entire time, except for meals and restroom breaks. I was roughly about 11, you know, 11 or 12, somewhere around in there. But after I finally graduated out of that program, boom, I would do something, turn over tables, throw a chair through a window. I tried to bite a staff on the neck. I was so out of control that they didn't know what to do with me. So finally, the director said that if I attacked another staff member, they'd kick me out of there. Now, I'm 12 years old. At this point, I'm 12 years old, and they're ready to kick me out of a detention center, okay? I mean, who does that? So, lo and behold, I attacked another staff member, and they sent me to jail, detention. So I'm in detention for a couple of days. I go to another detention center, Niles Home for Children. Now, let me paint a picture for you. Gillis Home in Kansas City is on the right side of town, the good side of town, the rich side of town, the historical side of town. They had a sprawling campus, playground. I mean, hey, they had all the donations. Anything that they wanted, they got, okay, because they were the right people, if you follow my meaning. Niles Home is in the hood. Niles Home only takes a certain kind of child. There was only two white children out of 30 kids when I went to Niles Home. I was 5 out of 40 or 60 children at Gillis Home of black kids, okay? So Niles Home, this is really interesting. You know, I go to Niles Home. Everything is fine for the first week. The honeymoon phase is what they call it. Well, I get angry, and I try to pull the same stuff that I pulled at Gillis Home. I picked up a chair, tried to throw it through a window. A gentleman by Mr. Booker told me to stop. I dropped the chair, but I still didn't stop what I was doing. So he came over and made me stop. Mr. Booker picked me up, slammed me to the ground, put his knee in my neck, and said, "You're not going to build a reputation off of me."
Wow.
And listen at this. After that, he got up and told me to go sit down and watch TV, and he didn't want to hear anything else from me. And I'm thinking in my head, wait a minute. I should be going to isolation for a couple of days because of what I just did, right? No. He's put me over there, put me in check, let me know that he was the alpha male, and he didn't have a problem out of me anymore. I was at Gillis Home for almost 3 years. Exactly. I was at Gillis Home for almost 3 years, acting out, going crazy, acting like an inmate, you know, violent, rage, everything else. But I go to Niles Home. Mr. Booker, he could have been a linebacker for a professional football team. Big old black guy. Lets me know that I'm not going to bring that stuff to his neighborhood. He let me know that he was the alpha male here. And immediately, my life began to change. Because over at Gillis, I was a wild animal doing whatever it is I wanted to do, and there was nobody there to convince me otherwise. But I go to Gillis immediately. I go to Niles, and immediately I'm put in check. So things began to take place for me at Niles. And I start going to public school. I hadn't been to public school in years, since 1984. This is now 1987. Okay? I get a girlfriend. You know, I'm beginning to live somewhat of a normal life. You know, I'm developing friendships. And, you know, I'm in trouble rarely. I stay at Niles Home for a year and a half, and I go to a foster home. I graduate. See, the way it is that you graduate from one phase of treatment to the next. And the ultimate is to be in a foster home or to be adopted, right? To, as they say, be put back into society. So I go to a foster home. And it was on the nice side of town. I went to a really, really nice school outside of Kansas City in a place called Raytown. I meet my best friend. And then I end up having an affair with my foster mother. From the age of 13 to 16, I'm sleeping with my foster mother. And my foster father doesn't know anything about it. So, needless to say, I began to act grown. And problems were happening at the foster home because I wasn't respecting my foster mother as a foster. She was my woman in my mind, you know. And this began to create issues with my foster father and I. And he didn't know what was going on. Well, it got so bad. And see, during this time, I'm doing debate and forensics, and right around the time when I lost the opportunity to go and be in the national championships, Cheryl had found, well, my foster mother had found out at the time that I had shared what was on between she and I with my best friend. And so she went and told, a therapist to get it off of her chest. And the therapist said that I had to leave. Well, I told my social worker that I wanted to leave. My foster father at the time didn't know what was going on. So they were going to put me in a psychiatric ward hospital because they had no other place to put me. A lot of times what happens is that the children in these situations, they get lost between the cracks, okay? Mm-hmm. They don't know who they come out of there not knowing really who or what they are, you know? And the system, because it's so overloaded with these children, they don't have any place to really put them. They don't know where to put them, so they try to find wherever there's an opening and shove them in there, you know, because they need a place to stay. So they were going to throw me to – they were going to put me in a psychiatric ward. And so I sat down with my social worker at the time, and since Cheryl had already told the therapist was required to report this, you know, and this is like only a couple dates, you know, had taken place. So I sit down and I tell my social worker, and she sends me to a foster home and brings charges against Cheryl with the assistance of the social worker, I mean the therapist that she had told. And so all this takes place, you know, and their story is a whole other deal because my foster father at the time, he and I are best friends to this day. You know, he was actually out there. The foster father with whose wife that I was sleeping with,
okay,
is actually, we're best friends to this day. I was the best man at his wedding a couple years ago. So that's a story that you might want to look into as well, because that's a whole other thing there. So I go to another foster family. I go ahead and work that on out because now I'm a junior in high school. So I graduate. I go to the Navy, and while I'm in the Navy, I meet this girl. Beautiful. She's going to the University of Hampton. And my godbrother was in the Navy with me. We were on the same ship. The story of my godbrother is the young man that I met when I moved in with this foster family, that whose wife I slept with, that I had an affair with. There was another kid at my school, and we became best friends, and eventually I asked his family to be my family. So we became really close, and we became brothers, just as a reference. So he's in boot camp with me. I mean, he's in the Navy with me. We're both stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, on the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. And we're always going to Hampton University because right there you have a whole bunch of HBCUs, historically black colleges. And you got Hampton University, Norfolk State, so on and so forth, right? Well, we always gravitated towards Hampton University because in our mind that's where all the girls were. You know, there was beautiful girls at Norfolk State too, but us, you know, we just like Hampton. And I remember I was 19 years old. I had just recovered from having my appendix taken out. And we're prowling on you know, Hampton's University. Yeah, as a sailor, that's what we do, you know. And I meet this girl. Had the biggest smile that could light up a room, light up the night. And she just captured me. So I kept on coming up there. You know, all the other girls that I was talking to, I forgot about them. And I just kept on coming up there, you know, talking to her. And at night we would take walks. because there was a river right by Hampton with a big old lighthouse. Well, you know, a little short lighthouse. So that the boats, when they came in, they could see it. We'd always walk around there and talk. And one thing led to the next. I asked her to be my girlfriend. And I was in love, you know. And as kids on their own, you know, exploring one another, on Thanksgiving, we all had a party, nice Thanksgiving dinner, and she goes home for Christmas break, comes back for the new semester and tells me that she's pregnant. And I start laughing. And at first, she thought that I was joking about the whole situation and taking it lightly. But I explained to her that this was one of the happiest things that could ever happen to me. Because never in a million years would I have imagined that I could have my own family. Okay, it's something that I always wanted, but I never put a lot of stock into. Because for so many years, I always, you know, with all the foster homes and group homes, I always had to try to fit into other people's families. You know what I mean? So, boom, I was happy that I had my own, but she's thinking about her college career, you know? So, we eventually get married. You know, she's originally from Alabama. I get out the Navy, go to the University of Kansas, and I end up going down to Montgomery, Alabama. We get married, we get an apartment, and we're not married for more than 3 months before I put my hands on her. I forget what the argument was. I know that I was asleep. She came in with our daughter. And Megan, you know, my daughter, she was making, you know, just being a little kid at night, you know, happy to see me and everything else. And I wake up and I flip out. And I, it started off with me grabbing her and pushing her and shoving her. I apologized for it and gave some lame excuse like I was tired or it's been a long day. She was a very independent woman. She was a very private woman. And so we kept it between us. I don't exactly remember how long it took for me to take advantage of that situation. Whenever I felt like I was losing control of how the conversation should be going or whenever I felt like she was challenging my quote-unquote authority, I would strike out at her, either verbally or physically. Our first separation came not more than 4 or 5 months after we were married. By this time, I believe I may have put my hands on her 3 or 4 times. I'm not for sure. but I remember this one clearly. We got into an argument. Like I said, for the life of me, I can't remember. But I remember running across the room, and I slapped her. And it wasn't a light pat. I mean, I struck her with an open hand. She came back at me. And I grabbed her, and I remember putting her in a headlock, and I flipped her over onto her back.
Wow.
I got up. Right. I got up.
Now, how old were you at this point?
At this time, I'm 21. We're both 21.
We're both of you are 21.
Huh?
I see. You're both 21.
We're both 21. And so I go to the bedroom. I come back into the living room. She's gone with our daughter. She goes over to her mother's house. Her father and her brother come that night to talk to me. And I remember this conversation. He asked me what the problem was, and I said nothing. And he asked me, why are you putting hands on her? And I told him, I don't know. Her father and her brother just looked at me like they wanted to do something to me right then and there. And they should have, because I attacked their daughter, you know? It's their right to defend her when I'm the one that should have been defending her. Well, he told me don't let it happen again. And so they get up and they leave. I'm sitting there not knowing what to say or what to think, because I'm being put to the test here, being called on my actions by two other guys who, when they look at me, I felt like crap. I felt like a coward, a punk, you know. So eventually she comes back. It happens again. She calls police. A restraining order is put on me. This is within, like I said, the first 6 months of us being married. So we separate. We get back together. Something happens. I'm being challenged. I'm being questioned on my authority or whatever I thought I had. I attack her again. And this became very repetitive. I cannot sit here and tell you how many times this happened. But I can tell you the final time. It was in 2004, June 24th, 2004. A lot of things had taken place in my life at this time. I got into the church. I got into the ministry. I even became a pastor. Okay. I came home. By this time, we had two other daughters by this time. So total, we have three daughters now. Some years have passed. This,
wow.
This is the final time. I come home, and I had a daughter that was 9, 4, and one about to turn 2. No, she was 2 at the time. Well, I come home, and an argument took place. Because I had just left our senior pastor's office, found out that she had had an abortion with our second child years before, right after our first one was born, right after I married, you know, the first time that we separated after the 6 months of us being married, she was pregnant again, but she told me she had a miscarriage. Come to find out, she had an abortion. So I come home. Evidently, someone had called her and told her. I come in. And I remember she was holding my youngest daughter in her arms, and my two other daughters were in the room. I walk up on my wife. I'm calling her out of her name, calling her out of her name, everything but a child of God. And I walk up on her, and I step on her foot because I'm trying to control myself. This is what I tell myself, right? I'm trying to control myself because I don't want to hit her in front of the girls. So I step on her foot as a way of getting at her, jabbing her, you know, getting the cheap shot in. And I shouldn't have did that because she hauled off and punched me in my mouth, knocked me almost all the way into the hallway. Point for her. At that moment, though, I totally lost control. And I had a set of keys in my hand. And I rushed her. I grabbed her by the hair. And I punched her repeatedly in the face with the set of keys in her hand. And blood began to fountain from her forehead, and it began to bathe my youngest daughter in her mother's blood.
Wow.
I go to jail. Yes. My children are screaming bloody murder. I come back to my senses, and I go to jail, and I go before the judge. We have a court hearing. At this time, I own a trucking company, my own little trucking company. And the judge didn't adjudicate the case. Instead, because this was my first, quote-unquote, documented case of abuse, he decided to send me to an anger management class. Now, I got to tell you, this is where the aha moment came. When I stood in front of the judge, and I'm going to be honest with you, he, at that point in time, was the alpha male because I was looking up to him, and he was telling me, looking me dead square in my face, that I had struck one of his women, a woman, a native of the state of Alabama, and he was going to give me 180 days, okay, 6 months. But because this was my first case, you know, he decided not to adjudicate it or give me the felony. So I go to this anger management class, and this just wasn't one of those 2-week anger management classes, you know. It was a 19-week class that pretty much took me almost a whole year to do because I had to leave because I was a truck driver at the time, you know. So in the class, this is where things began to change for me. This is where I made a decision that I'm sick and tired of being who I am, that I'm done with it, I'm through. I never wanted to be this person anyway because I have always hated myself to a certain degree, always hated myself, never liked myself. I would always paint a facade that I had it going on or that I had it all together. But Valerie, sir, I had it. I hated it. I hated myself with a passion. So in this anger management class, the first step that I took to break the shackles of my past, okay, was that I learned that every time I struck my wife, every time I got into a fight with another guy, I always made the decision to do so. Mm-hmm. And this was something that was hard for me to accept because it was just a natural reaction. You challenge me, you question who I am as a person, you know, you cross that line, then I respond this way automatically. You know, it was like, you know, an automatic reflex. But what I learned was that I chose to allow it to be an automatic reflex. Okay? The decision was mine all the time. And Valerie, I did not know that this was an option to me. Mm-hmm, I thought that this was just who I was. If you don't like it, you can leave and I'll get another woman or I'll get another friend, you know? But that was the first step that I took to becoming the person that I've always truly deep down wanted to be. I learned that it was my decision, and that became the foundation for my change, my total 180 going in the other direction. The second thing that I took and made my own and embedded in my heart was that I did not have to control other people. I did not have to control a situation, okay? Because it was actually out of my control because I can't control how person A, B, or C responds to me. And when it didn't go the way that I wanted to, I would try to make it go my way through use of force to try to control it. So the second thing was learning that, hey, the only thing that I can do is control how I respond to a situation. And that right there broke the biggest chain of all, the chain that was around my neck. Because I had always thought, remember, my father told me, this is how you control a woman.
This is how you do this.
This is how you do this. This is how you do this. And that right there freed me. Once I learned and accepted and embraced that I didn't have to control the situation or anybody else, I felt so much joy in my heart and so much stuff, I mean, so much weight came off of my shoulders. I cannot even, the only thing I could probably compare it to is when you finally decided to break free of your situation and you were truly free. I mean, it was the most amazing feeling in my life. The third step was that I had to sit here and notice what my red flags were or my trigger points, okay? A lot of times, you know, I believe that the abuser, when he goes to therapy or counseling, if he ever goes, is not really treated in the right way. You have to ask what he went through in his childhood. I got with a psychotherapist a while back, and like I said, I'm always graduating change. You know, I'm always welcoming it, and I'm always trying to take that step forward. And she told me that she was going to treat me like a PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, because I had triggers and I had red flags, and they would I would see something, and automatically it would trigger a memory subconsciously, mm-hmm. and I would respond to it in a negative way. So I learned what my triggers were, okay? I learned what situations I should avoid. I learned how to respond to a situation. So say, for instance, if I was to get involved in a situation today, confronted with someone that was aggressive, okay, that wasn't me years ago, immediately I would ask myself, okay, I would identify what's before me. And I would then think about the possible ways this could go. And then I would sit here and decide what it is that I would do if this happened or that happened, how I would respond. And more often than not, the best way, the way that I chose, because even after this, I was still placed in situations that would have triggered a behavioral trait that I had years ago. But because I had this process that I would go through, I would always choose to not respond at all. I never knew that was an option, that I didn't have to respond at all. You know, that gives you freedom because, hey, the only person I can control is myself. So one of the things that I would do on a continual basis, and even to this day, is to run myself through scenarios, even while I'm sitting here driving, okay? Because there's a lot of angry truck drivers out here, and I run into them all the time, you know? I put myself through situations. What would happen if this happens? What would I do? And this is something that I had to train myself. And now, before it would take a minute to do it, as I walked myself through it, now it's instantaneous. So I avoid situations. You know, I don't go to clubs. I haven't been to clubs in years because there are a lot of situations that could go wrong. So instead, I chose to surround myself with people that, in my mind, I believe were better than I was, that could provide an example. And hopefully I would take on their traits through osmosis, you know. So I started doing those things, and my life began to change immediately. Now,
well, Jason,
the important thing is,
you know what? One of the things is we have an hour show, and you have so much information, and I know this is, you know, some powerful stuff, and women who've been abused, they're getting some insight and understanding. I myself am getting some information from you, so I do applaud you for coming and being a part of the show, and I invite you to come back on the show next week as we continue this talk regarding domestic violence. And this is the very first time I've had someone talk from the abuser's perspective. So thank you so much, and hopefully you'll be able to join us again next week.
Hey, I'm at your disposal, Valerie.
Well, I appreciate you, and because we want to continue on with this, I want to find out, for those of you that are tuning in, we're talking to Jason Oliver, who's a motivational speaker, and, you know, the title tonight was Men Cry in the Dark, so we want to find out why they're crying in the dark, what's behind the mask. We're pulling back the layers to see what's beneath there. Why do men act out the way they do? Why do they respond to certain things? And as Jason was just sharing with us, and as we're about to wrap up the show, is that there were different triggers. And those of you that know, I've written 4 books, and my second book, Unveiling Secrets from the Heart, Forgiving Your Past to Free Your Future, I talk about those triggers that I experience even dating and moving forward in my life. So, Jason, if you would come back with us next week. There's tons of questions. I have a lot of people that want to ask you some important questions and information, and I want to thank individuals like Deborah White, who I made an appeal to make a donation, and I thank you so much, Deborah, for always holding up the arms of the soul of a woman and respecting what I do in the community. Thank you. Thank you so much for responding to the appeal. And those of you that don't know or tuned in late, I invite you to visit FromTheSoulOfAWoman.com and go on to the foundation page and click donate. You can donate as little as $10 or you can as much as you want. So please go visit the website, peruse the whole website so you can see all the different things that I do, so that you'll be able to better embrace the foundation and be a soul partner. Jason, thank you so much, Shirley. Jason had a lot to say, so we didn't get a chance to ask some questions that we wanted to ask them. But I invite you to please, please join me next Tuesday as we continue and hear this remarkable story of recovery. And remember, in closing, love affects our past, our present, and our future. Love is an emotion, a gift given to us from God, and it should never, ever hurt. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, Jason.
Hey, no problem, no problem. Like I said, I'm at your disposal. and any question is not off the table, okay? You can ask any personal question you desire because my story is here to help other people, you know?
Thank
so
you
no
so
secret.
Much.
No
Thank
problem.
Thank you.
No problem.
Good night.
Uh-huh.